The 70s, part 5, dance crazes. For many young people in the 70s, the style of dance became confusingly inseparable from the beat of the popular music as dance and music became one, known simply as, yes, you guessed it, disco. Disco was a dance style, a pulsating musical rhythm, and the name of a night spot for dancing. The word was as much a verb as a noun. You discoed at a disco, to disco. Never before had a club, a discotheque, given its name to the style of song and dance. And more, for many people, disco came to mean a mode of dress and a style of life. Discotheques existed some 3 decades before the birth of disco music. The clubs where dancers did the swing and jitterbug to music, recorded on discs, originated in Paris after World War II. Because a popular club had a rich library of musical discs, it was named after a book library, a bibliothèque. The coin neologism combined with the French disc and then the geek, the library. Disc libraries for dancing, on the order of Paris's popular whiskey a go-go, spread from France to England to America, where the chic Manhattan clubs like the Peppermint Lounge, Arthur's, and Sybil's, owned by Richard Burton's ex-wife, Sybil, were discos, though the music they played did not bear the name disco. Most observers of popular culture agree it was in the mid-70s a dance, the hustle, that unleashed disco mania on the nation. Hustle was purely an American invention. The hustle was created in the early 70s in East Harlem by black youths who could not afford to attend rock concerts or go into fashionable discotheques. Isolated, energetic, they began dancing a Latin beat called salsa, inventing their own footsteps and body shakes. The hustle, in its Latin and New York version, brought back touch dancing and vigorous athletic movements in which the male would spin his partner and acrobatically toss her into the air. In addition to its strenuous style, the hustle also set foot patterns like the foxtrot. Many said it was a Latinized hybrid of the jitterbug crossed with a foxtrot. The hustle gained popularity, writes Roberta Morgan in the book Disco, in the small private clubs in Harlem's El Barrio. Then it moved downtown, all around town, and discos started opening en masse. From blacks, gay men picked up the disco beat, and many of Manhattan's trendiest discos catered to a bisexual crowd. Then in 1975 came a hit instrumental song that kicked off the disco revolution nationwide, The Hustle, by Van McCoy and the Soul City Symphony. McCoy had already written a string of hits for Aretha Franklin and Gladys Knight and the Pips when he created the catchy tune, The Hustle. An instant hit from his album Disco Baby, the song shot to number one in July of 1975. The New York Times called it the biggest dance recording of the decade. It became an international bestseller and won a Grammy Award for Best Pop Instrumental of the Year. Ironically, The Hustle was the last cut on the album, and McCoy almost didn't record it. My partner kept bugging me about doing something with The Hustle, he said. I had just 1 hour of studio time left, so I sat down and wrote whatever came into my head. In essence, he transformed a dance he'd only recently seen into an irresistible musical beat. Expressed another way, he took a trend in dance and music wildly popular among blacks, gays, and made it mainstream. Though it is always risky to try and pinpoint when a trend begins, Van McCoy's recording seems the most reasonable starting point for viewing disco as we all remember it. For McCoy, who tragically died of a heart attack at the age of 35, The Hustle was his only single to make the top 40. Roberta Morgan pinpointed another trend starting with McCoy. The hustle and its effect on the proliferation of disco clubs and disco music. Disc jockeys and the airtime they granted a record had long determined the song's popularity. With the discos, she argues, dancers decided what would be popular, and the music they wanted to hear was the music they wanted to dance to. By 1978, America had over 2,500 discos, and 3 out of every 5 records cut in the country were disco. And 2, there were disco movies like, yeah, you guessed it, Saturday Night Fever. In 1977, TV star John Travolta, adored for his role of the sexy, lovable hood Vinnie Barbarino in Welcome Back, Kotter, donned a 3-piece suit, shiny black shirt, often open down to the chest, flamenco wedge shoes and gold chain, and defined disco for millions of moviegoers through the hit film Saturday Night Fever. His characterization of Tony Marino, for which he received an Academy Award nomination, it once made disco a cliché and a commercial bonanza. The movie, about a working-class boy from Bay Ridge section of Brooklyn, whose world comes alive on Saturday night through dance, was a disco how-to dance, dress, and score big with disco babes. The story was based on an article in the New York Magazine, June 7, 1976, by Nick Cohen, called Tribal Rights of the New Saturday Night, end of quote. The movie made Travolta a superstar and Tony an icon, and prompted hotels and airports to set up disco lounges so travelers would not be caught without a place to disco. As disco fever raged, elegant dance establishments like the Persian Room in New York's Plaza Hotel and the Empire Room in the Waldorf Astoria reported empty floors, and old dance halls like Roseland, where folk earlier had danced the Lindy, became discos to survive. Preeminent among the discos was Studio 54. Not since the Peppermint Lounge had there been a night spot so notorious and so hard to get into. At the height of disco mania, the Manhattan Dance Club on West 54th, which opened on April 26, 1977, by Steve Rubell and Ian Schrasier, who would later go to jail for income tax evasion, was the place where Liza, Liz, and Jackie O hosted private disco parties, where Bianca discoed atop a white horse, where the dressed all-in-black Halston watched bare-chested young men boogie, where Roy Cohen dabbed a runny nose, where Brooke wore her Calvins, and where Calvin Klein remarked, "Steve changed forever what people think of as nightlife in New York." After a visit to the club, Andy Warhol jotted in his diary, went over to Studio 54. The band struck up New York, New York, and they carried Liza in. Halston did photos with her. According to Vanity Fair editor Tina Brown, Rubell was a genius at social life, the greatest showman of the after-8 existence. And Studio 54 was his showcase. Newsday summed up Rubell's formula for success. He had a knack for creating a sense of mystique, courting the press, hiring good-looking waiters, and abusive doormen. Bob Colancio, an editor of Interview magazine, claimed that no matter where in the world he traveled, Chicago, Milan, Dusseldorf, or Dallas, he was barraged with the same question. "You're from New York? Can you get me in the Studio 54? As much a tourist attraction as the Statue of Liberty or Radio City Music Hall, Studio 54 drew people to New York in the slim hope of discoing with the stars. A beefy doorman who did not recognize Warren Beatty once turned away the star. Another doorman rejected Michael Douglas. To minimize embarrassment, celebrities either phoned ahead that they were coming or arrived with high-profile regulars. Studio 54 defined disco life in the 70s. It was the most exciting period for New York nightlife in the last 50 years, Halston reminisced in Newsday in the 80s. Every corner you'd see somebody you'd read about in the paper. Beautiful people, major stars. And two, those lucky ordinary folk who shuffled through the door because their trendy attire or knockout looks. Diana Ross would be sitting in a DJ booth, recalled Halston, and all of a sudden take the microphone and sing like it was a movie. The unapologetically bisexual atmosphere of Studio 54 made it a place unique to the decade, when for a time it was fashionable to know gays, dance with gays, and at the very least, watch gays dance. Studio 54 came to an end some 20 months after it opened, when the IRS charged Rubell and his partner with evading nearly $1 million in taxes. The disco's celebrity regulars were shocked, not only because their favorite spot was shut down, but because the IRS agents, searching the premises, had come up with a list of expensive poppers, quaaludes, cash, and cocaine, prompting speculation that the owners were not above luring in the beautiful people with gifts. Roller disco. The faddish marriage between disco dancing and roller skating, the latter a popular 70s pastime in its own right, took place in the rinks in Brooklyn and the Bronx late in the decade. By 1979, the Roller Skating Rink Operators Association of America reported that at least 70% of its members' rinks were equipped for roller disco, an expensive conversion in terms of lights and loudspeakers, but essential to survival. It's believed that roller disco began among younger people between the ages of 13 and 20, who, unable to get in the disco clubs that served liquor, strapped on wheels and began skating in a disco dancing style. The fad caught on when Olivia Newton-John, Robin Williams, and Linda Ronstadt appeared in national magazines as roller disco aficionados, and when Cher and Ringo Starr threw private parties at Los Angeles's Sherman Square Rink. What few people realized during the height of the roller disco mania was the fad had a 19th century precedent. Roller skates were invented by a Belgian musical instrument maker, Joseph Merlin, in the 1700s. And by mid-1800s, people were wild about gliding on wheels, a form of roller dancing. Many of the early pioneer roller rinks in England and America added music for skaters' pleasure. The most accomplished skater eager to display their skills began the roller dance. Most popular were the roller two-step and the roller waltz, both markedly genteel considering the bulk and the burden of Victorian clothes. During the gay 90s, the roller march was popular. A 10-step dance routine created by Franz Schuller and first performed at a Vienna rink in 1889. It was also used by ice skaters. In New York in the 70s, what Studio 54 was the disco, the Roxy was the roller disco. In 1979, the first roller disco magazine was published and pocketbooks released Jammin', a guide to dancing safely on wheels. Early in the next decade, the fad lost momentum, with the activity done more on the streets and in parks than in rinks and converted discos. Now, the source for this? Panotti's Parade of Fads, Follies, and Manias, The Origins of Our Most Cherished Obsessions, by Charles Panotti. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.